Have you seen the movie Avatar?
Yes, Avatar.
Yeah, Avatar. So the movie Avatar is basically about a man who's disabled, and then he plugs himself in to a new body of a blue alien creature.
Yes.
And through that body, he's able to experience a whole new world, and he has a whole beautiful experience. And it basically shows you how you can actually live through literally something referred to as an avatar.
Yes, exactly, something like that.
So they're actually they've already prepared the masses to experience kind of the beauty of the world through something which is entirely artificial, which is quite scary when you think about it. Sister Zainab, what are your immediate thoughts about this?
Since metaverse is not yet into like application, so we cannot talk much about it. But however, since like Facebook made a transition from on its name from Facebook to Meta, very quickly people went towards what is this Meta. The term was basically used in 1990s in a novel, wherein people abruptly went from a real world to the virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
So even the metaverse is a combination of two terms, meta and verse, and meta somehow it means virtual and verse a world. So what I think about it is, like you ask me what are my immediate thoughts about it, I at the same time it seems like it's amazing, it will be an amazing experience, but at the same time it is really scary and horrifying. Because the entire system will be controlled by an AI system, basically. And what is the thing that scares me the most is that we already, the social media and stuff, the internet, for until now we were thinking of a digital world is something wherein we surf on the internet, we spend hours on web and online shopping and stuff. Now this metaverse thing is something way beyond that, and the way we think the world is changing, it is changing much faster than that, actually, and we live in the heart of that change. And the thing that scares the most is that it will kind of, you know, detach you from the real world. The more you're in some partial physical world, because this is not a real world. That's, again, some partial world, again, some partially physically you're there, but not in the real world. The way we're addicted to social media apps these days and the internet, and this new thing is going to addict you very severely.
I can imagine. I mean, if normal video games and internet is this addictive already through Instagram and Facebook, imagine if you could actually go into a world and see it and visualize it and feel it. It's going to completely addict people.
Yes.
Now, I want to quickly go back, and I'd like to get both of your opinions on this and your thoughts. Let's go back to the idea and the analogy given through the movie The Matrix, because it really is interesting. Most of the time, Hollywood is just trying to indoctrinate the masses and actually brainwash people. But sometimes they create something accidentally which reveals a lot of the reality in which we find ourselves living. So in The Matrix, just as a quick recap, you see that the main character, he's bored of his usual life. He's just working day to day in an office. And then he realizes that something else is wrong with the world that he lives in. And then he goes to a group who are referred to as terrorists. And these terrorists actually teach him that the world in which he lives is fake. It's actually a computer simulated reality. And what they realize is, in the real world, human beings have all been plugged in to that virtual reality, which is known as the Matrix, and they're being used by artificial intelligence as batteries. They're actually powering a machine. Their bodies are being used to power a machine. Now, if we take this analogy and go back to the idea of the metaverse, that's precisely what they could potentially create, because people are just going to be plugged in into the metaverse, and they're going to need to fuel that metaverse with their own selves.
Yes,
right?
With their time, their
time, their money, their energy, their effort. They're going to pay money so that the internet keeps on running. And why do they want it to be continuously running? So that they can enjoy the pleasures of that metaverse. the metaverse, you mentioned about Facebook, and this brings Mark Zuckerberg into the picture, and these ruling elites who are essentially, you know, they're running the planet.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I want to ask a question. What does the metaverse imply when it comes to love and sympathy, crying, helping others, you know, all of these human emotions that we have? What are the implications for?
Well, I don't think that these sorts of worlds are created to make people connect to each other more and more. I mean, maybe the slogan is that way, but the reality is going to be another thing. You're going to have bubbles of your own. You're going to pick which time to see others, which people to isolate, where to be in a crowd, when not to be in a crowd. So I don't think that would help a lot to be together, to help each other in our crying, to soothe each other, to consolate each other. That's more of a personal thing. Mm-hmm. I think it would be more personal. You're going to be more isolated and alienated from the others. That's what I would think.
Yeah, I mean, one of the slogans of Facebook is, you know, connecting people. That's what we're doing. We're connecting people across the world. We're doing a great thing.
But what is the reality? Aren't we getting more alone?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it making us more
isolated,
feeling like more lonesome?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that the exact opposite has happened. We've become isolated. People feel more detached from each other than ever before.
And the virtual connections are usually not sort of real. They are not alike as the real connections. You may connect to other people's, you may write to each other, you may have some pen pals, but that's not exactly like the real experiences you have with other people. The eye contact does matter. The touch of each other would matter. So when you are going to help a person who's crying, you have to be around them. You have to hear their voice. You have to be close to them. That's what I mean.
According to me, I think it's a completely user-dependent thing. Every creation we see has a positive impact and a negative impact. Like right now, we are seeing, I don't know, we experienced coronavirus, we experienced Delta variant, and now this Omicron, or I don't know, so many things coming up. Hey, at the same time, you know, we are so much recommended in Islam to go for Sila Rahim, to, you know, meet people, to
But surely we're doing that through social media. I mean, I'm in a completely foreign country, away from my family.
Yes.
I'm able to interact with them.
This is the positive.
Media.
This is a positive phase of this thing. You know, you can. I said this is a completely user-dependent thing. You can completely. It depends on you. Einstein never created electricity. He never intended that people will someday use the same electricity to give electric shocks to humans,
yes,
to animals, and like, you know, so many other disadvantages.
Of course, all the creations are done for your benefit, and it depends on how you use them.
How you use it.
But I don't think they are the same. The sort of association you make according using these tools, I don't think would be the same as they are in the real world.
And the worst thing is that you're going to escape from the real world. You're going to, you know, be in a more fake world and in a more virtual world. But at the same time, it is nice, you know. I saw the same kind of thing while I was on the trip to Arba'in, and people were like experiencing the as if they were in the shrine of Imam Hussein al-Islam. So in that way, it was a positive thing when, you know, everyone, not everyone around the world can come for ziyarat.
Yes.
Not everyone can
those.
Afford.
I mean, granted, social media has lots and lots of pros and cons, and the cons, you know, the pedophilia and meeting people who you're not really, who you don't really know who they are. They could be predators, etc., etc. But hold on a moment. If I'm in a foreign country and I can't physically see my family, the metaverse sounds like a brilliant idea.
It
I'd be able to see my mom, and, you know, I'd be able to talk to her and others too, my cousins. You know, I think that the metaverse could be a really good idea.
I told you, it's a tremendous experience.
We've been discussing it with Sister Asma and Sister Zainab. Thank you both for being here today and discussing this important topic with me. From myself and from the sisters, we bid you Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions, vaccine hesitancy and scepticism. Is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They say they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. Is not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see? A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. 400, sometimes more. This bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outbursts, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country.
On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000, and overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million.
We take things lightly, as usual. And we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious.
Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in five key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa, and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors and health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices, and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds, graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, three times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. US medical centers are already overwhelmed, and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the U.S., already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rising prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S., and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mohammed was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Purizza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a higher rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea.
The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife.
Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, South Korea.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Amazon and Google are actively working to build and improve the technological infrastructure the Zionist regime needs to surveil Palestinians and confine them to the ghettos the Israeli regime's army has created for them. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jonathan Cook, journalist. This article is published under the heading Amazon and Google, Partners in Israeli Regime Apartheid. Stay tuned for more. The best-selling Irish novelist Sally Rooney is openly shunning the Israeli regime after recent reports from human rights groups warned that the Zionist regime practices apartheid, systematically oppressing Palestinians under its rule. But while the Israeli regime risks becoming a pariah among some cultural producers, it is being aggressively embraced by globe-spanning corporations like Amazon and Google, among the wealthiest companies in history. The two tech giants are not just lining up to do business with the Israeli regime, they are actively working to build and improve the technological infrastructure the Israeli regime needs to surveil Palestinians and confine them to the ghettos the Israeli regime's army has created for them. Through their collaboration on the Zionist regime's project Nimbus, both companies are helping to remove any pressure on the Israeli regime to make peace with the Palestinians and are instead becoming partners in Israeli regime apartheid. Now, workers for both companies are speaking out, most of them anonymously for fear of what they call retaliation. This month, some 400 employees of the two companies published a letter in the Guardian newspaper warning that Amazon and Google were contracted to supply dangerous technology to the Israeli regime military that would make this regime's rule over Palestinians even crueler and deadlier. The $1.2 billion contract for Project Nimbus awarded earlier this year means the two tech firms are to build data centers in the occupied territories on behalf of the Israeli regime military. Senior staff will need the Israeli regime security clearance to work on the project. In a sign of how aware the Zionist regime is of the potential backlash against Amazon and Google's involvement, the contract bars the tech corporations from withdrawing due to pressure from either employees or growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement. The terms of the contracts are also being kept under wraps to prevent scrutiny. The tech giants' wish to avoid publicity is understandable. Each pays lip service to ethical business practices. Google claims that firms can make money without doing evil, while Amazon's leadership principles state a commitment to make better, do better, and be better. Providing the Zionist regime with the technological tools to better enforce both its belligerent military occupation and its apartheid policies privileging Jews over Palestinians looks suspiciously like making a lot of money from colluding with evil. In the words of the whistleblowing staff, Amazon and Google's collaboration allows further surveillance of and unlawful data collection on Palestinians and facilitates expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. Neither Amazon nor Google responded to a request for comment on the concerns raised in the letter. Two employees, Gabriel Chabiner, a software engineer at Google, and Bathul Sayed, a content strategist at Amazon, went public on NBC's website shortly after publication of the letter in The Guardian. They gave examples of how the Zionist regime would be able to use Amazon and Google's computer services to help enforce the occupation. Data would be used to identify Palestinian homes for demolition in what are often moves towards land clearances by the Israeli regime to build or expand illegal settlements. And the information collected and stored on the services would guide attacks on build-up areas in Gaza, which the Israeli regime has been blockading for the past 15 years. In previous military campaigns, the Zionist regime has bombed Palestinian hospitals, schools, and universities. Amazon and Google servers will also assist the Zionist regime's Iron Dome missile interception system, which has helped the Israeli regime neutralize rockets from Gaza so that it can maintain an enforced quiet from Palestinians as it keeps them caged and imposes a starvation diet for the enclave's inhabitants. The two employees also noted that Amazon and Google will be directly implicated in the Israeli regime's wider apartheid policies of the kind criticized earlier in the year by human rights groups, including the Israeli regime occupation watchdog B'Tselem. Nimbus will serve the Israel Land Authority, which not only allocates lands for illegal settlements, but oversees discriminatory policies in land allocation inside the occupied Palestinian territories that openly privilege Jews over the fifth of the Israeli population who are Palestinian natives. The Zionist regime claims these so-called Israeli Arabs are equal citizens, but they suffer systematic discrimination, as B'Tselem and New York-based Human Rights Watch have highlighted. Amazon and Google have ignored previous calls from staff to prioritize Palestinian rights over increased profits from colluding in Israeli regime's war economy. In May, many hundreds again anonymously urged both companies to sever their ties to the Israeli regime military shortly after it killed almost 260 Palestinians, including more than 60 children, in an attack on besieged Gaza Strip. Figures published this month demonstrated the Israeli regime's central place in the global digital economy. Despite its tiny size, the Israeli regime's share of high-tech investments now amounts to a third of those made in European countries. The fake regime of Israel has particularly benefited from growing demand in the West for its surveillance technologies, cyber weapons, and developments in militarized artificial intelligence. The Israeli regime military and offshoot startups launched by retired troops have a competitive edge, claiming that their technologies have been battle-proven on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to reports in local media, the Zionist regime is poised to become a global data crossroads. In addition to Amazon and Google, Microsoft, Oracle, and IBM are all expected to build server farms in occupied territories to cash in on the greater integration of digital and military technologies. The critical role of the Israeli regime in high tech, from its Intel chip plant to firms like AnyVision and Onavo that offer specialized surveillance, facial recognition, and data mining technologies, means no one can afford to fall out with the Israeli regime. Google and Facebook have already faced criticisms for their work with the Israeli regime censoring Palestinians on social media or making them invisible on online maps. Getting either Amazon or Google to honor their public commitments to ethical behavior by withdrawing from Project Nimbus may prove much harder, and not only because of the contractual obligations the Israeli regime has insisted on. The Zionist regime has become too integral to the global surveillance and war industries for any tech giant to risk antagonizing it, with profits galore to be derived from closer collaboration with the military-industrial complex. The pressure will be on to forge closer bonds with the Israeli regime, whatever its human rights record. And with the Zionist regime lobby deeply ensconced in Western capitals, the tech corporations will not wish to risk the reputational damage of being tarred as anti-Semitic for boycotting the Israeli regime. Pressure may be mounting on many companies to distance themselves from the Israeli regime over its occupation and apartheid policies. But for Amazon and Google, it is those very practices of occupation and apartheid that are a tech seam waiting to be mined.
Seven down at pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The Muslim world is very diverse, and also there's a scale of Muslims. What I mean by this is that you have Muslims who are really good, regardless of the madhab or the school of thought that they follow. And then you have the vice versa, of those Muslims who are really bad, and also, you know, regardless of the madhab that they follow. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that deals with the Ja'fari school of thought in particular, but also trying to show that, you know, there is a place for coming together, for tolerance, for cooperation. It is a very small book, but it's a book that is worth reading. You know, it gives a good overview of the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, or as the author puts it, the Ja'fari school of thought. And also in this particular time of ours where there are so many interactions globally, and you know, it's very easy for somebody to be misled by certain things they see on the internet or by certain things that some people say. This is a good reference to have by saying, okay, no, you know, one of the things that we should learn is that if we want to know something, we should go and ask the people who are following that particular sect or that particular school of thought. And we don't come with up. Rather, we should not make our own conclusions based on our own understanding of what we have read. No, go and ask. So, inshallah, in our next segment, we hope to introduce this book to the audience, and we hope that it will benefit them. So, inshallah, please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So without further ado, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled The Truth As It Is. This book was written by Ayatollah Sheikh Ja'far al-Hadi, marhum rahmatullah alayh. Just a very brief explanation of who he was, that the Ayatollah was an expert in various Islamic sciences, and he has many books. And he has worked, you know, quite, you know, a long time with the Ahlul Bayt Wal Assembly and also their book council. He was born in the city of Karbala, Iraq, in the year 1946, and he passed away not too long ago, about a year or so ago, in December of 2020 in the holy city of Qom. So this book was published by the Ahlul Bayt Wal Assembly Publishing and Printing Center, which is in the city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It was translated by Badr Shaheen, and it's a very small book. It is not very large. It contains eight different, you know, parts and portions where a person can go and find out about the school of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. And as the author writes, he says, the present book is a fresh breath for all of us by giving us a clear picture of the main doctrines and religious injunctions of the Ja'fariyya Imamite Shi'i or Shia, whose individuals live together with their brethren from the various Muslim sects. They are deeply concerned about maintaining the entity and dignity of Muslims and are ready to sacrifice everything for it. So this is what the book tries to do, as mentioned previously. It tries to, first of all, explain the Ja'fari school of thought. Again, very briefly, you know, it does not go into much detail. Regardless, it's a basis a book like kind of bullet pointing the beliefs. And after that, it goes into saying that, okay, this is how we can tolerate and cooperate with, or our beliefs rather, regarding toleration, cooperation, and the other religious schools of thought. So, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a section of this book for the benefit of our dear brothers and sisters. So, inshallah, please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced in this program is titled Truth As It Is, written by the late marhum Sheikh Ayatollah Jafar Al-Hadi, rahmatullah alayh, and translated by Badr Shaheen, and printed by the Ahlul Bayt Wal Assembly in the city of Qom. So as mentioned, this book is an attempt to outline very briefly the beliefs of the Shia or the Ja'fari Shia. And the reason why the author may have mentioned the term Ja'fari, because we know in history there were many other Shi'i schools of thought, like the Ismailiyya or the Kaysaniyya and so on and so forth. So maybe that is why he mentioned the word Ja'fari there in particular. But anyway, the author, in continuing and in the very beginning in terms of this coexistence, and so he writes that when Islam dawned, peoples were so disunited that they ignored each other. Furthermore, they were involved in conflicting and wrangling against each other. With the spread of Islam among these peoples, ignorance of each other turned into mutual acquaintance, rivalry into cooperation, and disassociation into reciprocal relations. This change is one of the blessings of the monotheistic precepts of Islam, which was the prime motive of the emergence of a great united nation that introduced to the world a magnificent culture and protected its individuals from the evils of oppressors and tyrants, and succeeded to win the world's respect and become become the object of veneration in the eyes of all despots and arrogant rulers. This is written under the verse where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the 49th chapter of the Holy Quran, the 13th verse, "We have made you tribes and families that you may know each other." So this is the author, and this is his attempt to kind of show unity by, first of all, explaining the beliefs of the Ja'fari Madhab, explaining the beliefs with regards to cooperation and so on. And then to say, okay, where can we unite? Where can we live as a people in peace and harmony? We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala firstly to send His mercy on the author who served Islam very diligently and very sincerely. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of those who benefit from His writings and who benefit Islam and who do read for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.